But what my middle daughter did by doing her investigating, by really being tenacious, and then Tara, in the end, being the hero also, I feel like we're the survivors, and I think we appreciate life so much more now.
Real Crime Profile is brought to you by many wonderful sponsors such as Zip Recruiter, Madison Reed Hair Color, Quip Toothbrush, and Man Crates. We are so thankful to have their support and so happy whenever they have a special offer just for our Real Crime Profile listeners. So please, when you hear one of these special opportunities to try a new fantastic service or product, do go over and check them out. We can't do our show without you, and we certainly cannot do it without the companies who make our show possible. You can find the most recent sponsor offer in our show notes, on our Facebook page, and on our website, realcrimeprofile.com. Thanks so much, and thanks for listening to Real Crime Profile.
It is the chilling tale of blind love.
I was worried that John was going to kill me to try to get the money because I had married him.
And lies.
The papers show that John has numerous names, numerous social security numbers.
A handsome, volatile con man.
He said I was a whore and a bitch and I was going to pay for what I did.
He was the most evil person I've ever met.
And a woman who fell for him.
He got into my car, started it, and set it on fire.
Setting in motion a chain of events with deadly consequences.
At that point, I realized I'm his latest victim.
Hi, lovely listeners. Welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me today in the studio is...
Lisa Z. It's Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And it's such a shame that Jim can't be with us. He's headlong into a case and he really wanted to be in the studio and talk with our super special guest that we've brought back because we still have so much more to ask her. And our special guest is...
Deborah Newell, survivor of Dirty John.
And I'm so glad you said that, Deborah, survivor. Because you have survived quite an incredible experience. Although some people might say, well, it's incredible, but actually many other people have gone through. I know from many of our listeners, people who reach out, I have hundreds and hundreds of emails from women and some from men, but women in particular who say, wow, that coercive control that you were talking about, you just completely described my life. Yeah. And I listened to everything that you said. And we've had some incredible emails where, you know, and I'm thinking about a number in particular, and I won't name the people where they've said, I just listened to everything you said and I left and I've managed to leave safely. And you changed my life. And I think that is something that is so powerful. And I know that's something that really chimes with you, Deborah, because you really want people to learn.
Oh, yes.
From what happened.
Right. And this kind of predator, this kind of predation, you know, it goes across any income level, rich, poor, urban, country, also crosses ethnicities, crosses ages. We've had people as young as 18 years old, wow, you know, write to us saying that they're this is happening to them. And even, you know, in their 70s and they have long-term marriages and they're victims and survivors. You know, I don't have the same issue with the word victim, Laura. Maybe you could talk me through this, but I really feel like I want to take back the word victim because so many people who write to us are only now realizing that they can say that something bad happened to them, that they can acknowledge, yeah, somebody fucking put me through the shit. And I in order to heal, I have to acknowledge I was a victim and now I'm getting over it. But people are really afraid of that word because it implies weakness. And I don't, for my own self, I don't think it's a weak word. But I know a lot of people have a different opinions.
Yeah,
about
I mean,
that.
We have a lot of dialogue about this in the sector because, you know, and I stand by the fact that when someone's going through something, they're being victimized. Okay, so when they are out the other side of it, they have survived and they're a survivor. And I only ever use those terms down the track when you know that you are fully out of it. And there is something about, you know, being empowered to know that you survived something and actually you've turned. What I always hear from Deborah is how she turns adversity and things that have happened into her life into a strength. And so that's some of the things, the empowerment, how I work with other, you know, people who have been victimized, so that they don't claim victimhood when, certainly when you have post-traumatic stress, you can get stuck in this victimhood pattern that things happen to you and you have no control over it. So it's a way of giving somebody the empowerment, the strength, the validation. Yes, they've been through something, but at some point you want to ensure that they go on this journey so that they then start to feel they're back in control. And it's not a reactive process, it's a proactive process. And now they are in control of their life and their experiences, their thoughts, all the while in the knowledge that, yes, there are these dangerous individuals out there and these predators who will fish in certain pools. And unfortunately, you know, online dating and free dating sites means that it attracts predators because they fish in those pools that when we're looking for love, we all render ourselves more vulnerable than would what we would be in any other situation because we're looking for a match. Yeah. We want to share as much information as possible so that we identify that match. So the whole victim to survivor to, you know, having survived right at the end of it. And that's where I put Deborah, Jacqueline and Tara. They're all incredible sheroes who took decisions that kept them alive. And so, you know, lots of people do sit back and I see this a lot. Well, that would never happen to me, or I would have done this, or why did they do that? Or right away we go into victim blaming as soon as we say, well, that wouldn't happen to me because I'm X, Y, or Z. I mean, I've worked with every kind of client you could ever, every type of person that you will ever come across. And it's actually much more down to how a perpetrator targets. It's not a particular type of victim in this case. It's how a perpetrator targets, you know, individuals. And suffice to say, and this is Professor Evan Stark's quote, and I made sure it was in our legislation, having changed the law in England and Wales. And the quote says that not only is coercive control the most common context in which women are abused, it's also the most dangerous. These are the cases that correlate positively to lethality. These are the cases where women and girls are much more likely to be killed. And in fact, a study by the University of Gloucestershire in the UK, and I believe it's a 2016 study, showed that out of 376 murders, 94% of them had coercive control and stalking in them. 94%. Most of the murders that I review, coercive control features along with stalking. And the coercive control happens in the relationship. And I talked on our last podcast, you know, the behaviours are all very different. You know, it can be about charm that disarms and love bombing. It can be about gaslighting, this reality distortion of using psychological means into manipulating a victim so they doubt their own sanity, so that the perpetrator can convince somebody that it's one thing, even though they know that it's something else. So, you know, still we have this challenge about educating people about what coercive control is, and that's in the classroom. That's on, you know, the podcast when we first introduced the concept, changing the law. We're doing a push now to try and change the law here in California. The East Coast has just started as well in New York, Texas. There's a number of states, you know, and I believe a lot of this is driven by what happened to you, Deborah. And certainly, you know, the big push around here, California, is on the back of you surviving and wanting to make a big difference and make change as a legacy to help other women, which is really an incredible testament to you.
Well, thank you.
And where's your heart now, Deborah? I mean, are you, do things still trigger you, you know, the trauma, or do you feel, like Laura said, in control? I mean, where are you at right now?
Well, I'm a lot more wise. as far as where I'm at, I look at men differently. I tend to look at people a little bit differently. I don't think I'm bitter whatsoever, but I look for the red flags now. I don't take people at their word as much as now. I look into the background of people. I'm not dating. Right now I'm too busy.
Right.
And I'm not ready.
Right.
I really needed to analyze what I was doing wrong so I didn't repeat it. Not that I felt that I did anything wrong with John as far as his behavior, but I could have not dated him if I would have looked into his background, so on and so forth, before I got hooked in.
But there were a number of things that you did that didn't come out actually, you know, previously on the podcast, measures that you took. I mean, you spoke to a psychiatrist to understand John's mindset.
Yes.
You actually took a lot of proactive measures. I'd like you just to describe some of those things for our listeners to understand.
Okay. Well, I did many things. I went to police. Once I knew who he was, I needed to study who he was and my behavior, what I needed to do in order to protect myself. I literally went to policemen to try to get restraining orders. Obviously, I went beyond and saw him at one point, which I shouldn't have, but I did. I was trying to get him to settle with me.
Well, you thought you could manage the situation.
I thought I could manage it.
I always say victims are the expert in their own situation,
right.
And you're trying to manage something and survive.
I'm thinking there's no way he's going to kill me if I'm going to settle with him
right.
And I'm going to give him money. You know, that money I thought was more important than murder. The things that I did was I hired a private investigator, in fact, two, and really looked into who he was along the way. I studied anything I possibly could about John, every article, every piece of paper, anything I could get my hands on. I still have files probably 3 feet deep of things that I've investigated. Took pictures. Everywhere I went, I took a picture. I hired this Secret Service guy that actually had worked for the president, four presidents. I hired a forensic psychiatrist so I could understand his mind.
So you wanted to understand the psychology of what was motivating him and what
the
was
the psychology,
happening.
And I needed to be one step ahead. So
this was after you had dated, you had gotten married,
right.
And then things went sour and you tried to separate from him and get away from him. This is at this point.
Yes. I learned you don't just walk away. Without a plan.
Right. Oh.
So the exit strategy, the safety planning side is absolutely vital. And these are the things people didn't really understand. When I got to know you and you were telling me about this, I felt it's very important that our listeners understood the proactive measures that you took when you understood what a risk he was.
Yes. I went into hiding. Well, first of all, if you walk away and you haven't done anything, you know, you haven't protected your business, your money, you know, anything like that, you really need to make sure. I started pulling money out.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know he had every one of my accounts and he was tracking me doing this. I have two cars. And so I would always take the car. I'd always ask him, here, you take the Tesla because I could track it. And see where he was, make sure he wasn't with me or near me. I had the advantage of working full-time. And that means, that financial means was important to John. So I wasn't completely isolated because I could be at work 10 hours a day and be myself. Other things that I did, I went to police stations. I went to almost every police station around my area, nobody did a thing.
Yeah, what did they say to you?
It's crazy.
What did you say to them and what did they say to you?
Some of the things that they said to me were, just go home. You guys are having a marital spat.
Which is a big no-no,
yes,
by the way,
exactly.
In these cases.
Yeah.
Really.
And I thought, wait a minute.
Oh, my God.
You don't know who this guy is. One of the police officers was annoyed with me, and I'd sat there with my girlfriend 4 or 5 hours. And I said, they said, there's not a direct threat. There's not a mark on you. And I said, there's going to be. It's going to be too late.
Exactly. That's
And this is why asking the questions about risk, using the DASH risk assessment model, training police officers to be able to use it, ensuring that you have an advocate with you.
So important.
So that you can challenge what's being said in the legal framework.
Right.
And too often people are dismissed. And of course, it can put you even more at risk. But you didn't give up, did you? You still continue trying to ensure that they understood the risk to you. and the risk to police. I mean, right. he'd threatened police officers that if they'd checked their own intelligence databases.
Right.
And this is why serial perpetration, you know, when people get away with things, they just carry on doing it.
Right.
And if there were a register for serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders, he would be a prime candidate. And then the police would go and check the intelligence. They'd see that he was on the register. And then they would focus on him rather than on your behavior and
right.
saying, why didn't you do X, Y, and Z? And that's the whole point of why we're trying to create a national register in the UK, but also here we're talking about it as well, so mm-hmm. that it's not dependent on somebody who's being abused and victimized going in and then being dismissed, you know, or not being believed.
Right.
John didn't seem like he had it all together. He didn't have a car. He had elaborate stories about how his car and all his other belongings and stuff was stolen out of a storage unit, and that seemed very fishy to me. He also just didn't seem like he had a job, even though he said he was an anesthesiologist, and he claimed to be going to work, but I was very skeptical about that. Something about that didn't seem right.
He was a threat to police too. So, you know, I find it incredibly difficult when we were first interacting mm-hmm. and you were telling me all these times and these attempts where mm-hmm. you were mm-hmm. advocating for yourself and they were right. just dismissing you out of hand.
Yeah, it was interesting. And then I moved him to Vegas. I needed investment property, but I thought, if I move him there, he can be working on the house and I can be working in Orange County. So that was another way to get him away from me. I don't think that I thought, and nor did anyone else, that he was going to hurt my kids.
Mm-hmm.
There were threats, but he had nothing to gain if he hurt one of them. It was me because of the money. He wanted the money. Okay. So I didn't look at it that way.
And of course, you know, you're absolutely right. You were the primary target.
Right.
But we always, when we, you know, do risk assessments, particularly in stalking cases,
mm-hmm.
you know, he'd stalked multiple women.
Right.
And particularly with his background, where he used sort of the mafia backdrop and mm-hmm. understood the way to get to somebody, his psychology,
that
used their family and through mm-hmm. their children. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what we saw translate here,
right.
sadly. But you know, daughters were real sheroes and he probably didn't really understand who he was taking on.
Right.
I mean, Jacqueline, who had put the tracker on his car and was monitoring him and
she's
getting...
She's my own little private investigator.
She was incredible.
She is. So good. Oh, my goodness.
Had yeah. he done that before? Had he gone to that extent of hurting the peripheral family around one of his stalking victims? Or was this like a new boundary
this was new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And part of sort of the spiraling and the unraveling, you know.
He's not getting what he wants.
Yeah. And so mm-hmm. that's the other thing, you know, with perpetrators, all will be well if they get what they want.
Right.
And so right. when things were good, he didn't need to use threats or do anything. But when, you know, people were being resistant to him, and even with Jacqueline and Tara, where they were resistant mm-hmm. to him, mm-hmm. that's where the threats started to come in and him isolating you from them mm-hmm. and kind of mm-hmm. the Machiavellian divide and rule, separating you all
right.
from each other emotionally mm-hmm. and also in distance. But yes, those threats to Jacqueline in particular, and she gave him, she did, and quite rightly. And she saw yeah. straight through him.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
very adept.
Oh, yeah.
Having met both your daughters,
yeah.
she's super adept and astute. And she oh. sees through people.
She has a sixth sense.
She really yeah. does. And mm-hmm. so the action that she took as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I know at times she felt that she wasn't heard.
Mm. Right.
But I think there were times where all those dots for you connected. You know, and certainly Jacqueline's warning to Tara, mm-hmm. I think, played a big part in Tara's being on red alert, ready for something when
right.
John appeared.
Right.
And, you know, of course, there were some other interventions, thank goodness, where,
yes.
you know, he was over 6 foot at the time and Tara, mm-hmm. you know, much shorter than he. And so the physicality was stacked very much against Tara, but mm-hmm. her managing to fight tooth and nail and get the knife away from him.
Right.
I mean, and the knife landing close to her hand for her to be able to even pick it up. was a real manna from heaven, and thank goodness. But Jacqueline did play a key role in terms of understanding who he was, but also warning Tara that he was in the neighborhood when she saw him.
Yeah. The one thing that is very interesting, though, is John was 6'2", 6'3". He said 6'3", but probably 6'2".
Knocking an inch off.
Tara, 5'2". And when John was spiraling out of control, because I was winning at his game, I was...
You were outsmarting him.
Yeah.
You were one step ahead of him.
Yeah, with a lot of help, must I say. But the one thing is, he had lost 53 pounds between the time I left him and when he was when he died.
Which is a lot.
53 pounds. So he was out of control in every area. I don't know if drugs played a big role in that or him just feeling so out of control.
Highly likely the drugs taking a toll on him. And his decision-making ability.
Yeah.
When you feel like you're losing control, and this is the irony, his way of trying to take control was doing this catastrophic thing of seeking out your children because he couldn't get to you.
Right.
So looking for Jacqueline, and then looking for Tara.
Right.
Yes, there was a spiral, and fortunately he wasn't thinking as... clearly, but, you know, even the leaving part, you know, I will just say for the benefit of our listeners, you know, at the point of separation, because I remember Shad, your nephew, basically saying, when my aunt was going to leave him, I thought everything would be okay. But of course, the leaving part, the separation, that's when risk can escalate.
Yeah.
Many women stay because they know it's too dangerous to leave. And that's a real paradox. But when you leave and you took every measure to leave safely, that there was a plan, there was a strategy in place. And of course, that's when things escalated. And that's when his behavior became even more dangerous.
One thing that I feel I'm very lucky is that I had the means to leave. A lot of these women don't have the means to leave.
That's right. The financial and the economic part of abuse can keep you very much entrapped.
Or the support, even.
Support from people. Yeah. You know, if you've been isolated from people around you, well, then who do you go to? Where do you run to if you've lost your family and your friends in that process? And maybe you believe the perpetrator over them. So, yeah, there are multiple layers of challenges. And for you, you did have the means, thank goodness. And that's why Paladin in the UK, it's a free service where you get an independent advocacy caseworker, a stalking expert. And you don't have to pay for legal advice on the criminal justice side or the civil justice side, because it can be very costly. Not only is your life at risk and you're trying to talk to the police, but you're being told to take out orders, and all these things cost money.
Right.
And if you don't have the money, you're entrapped. You're stuck in a situation. So again, that's why sometimes people don't leave. But it does take on average about seven times to leave safely.
That's amazing.
Right.
Took me one, but because I had the means.
The means, the access, the resource. But this story, I mean, your case could have ended very differently, Deborah.
Oh, yes.
And we've talked about that. When I first listened to the podcast before it even dropped, and when I was listening to the opening of Dirty John, and, you know, I'd suggest to our listeners, do go and listen to the podcast. Even if you listen to it once, I've listened to it so many times. And, of course, we've spoken many, many times since. But that sort of opening where Chris Goffard is in the morgue, you know, and the autopsy is sort of being listed in terms of the injuries, and it's a very brutal murder. And the way that you hear about the case, your mind, certainly for me, once you had been introduced, just naturally went to, oh, this is another horrific domestic violence murder that's stalking related. And now we're about to hear where all the warning signs fitted in. But of course, there are all these twists and turns that happened in this case, but that it could have had a very different outcome.
Oh, yes.
And those measures that you took, the advice that you proactively sought out from multiple professionals, is the piece that's missing, I think, in the narrative that people don't understand. That you took every precaution, you know, the wigs that you were wearing, staying in different hotels, not renting the same car. You knew that he was tracking you and trying to access you.
Well, you don't do what you normally do. You completely go a different path. I changed every email. I changed everything I could think of. I didn't eat at the same restaurants. I didn't dress the same. Nothing was the same.
And that's an important part. you know, there's a real strategy and there was a plan in place. And, you know, the clients who tend to come to me or even through mm-hmm. Paladin, you know, they're at that last point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd rather that we were educating people about the early warning signs of abuse right. and children, you know, little boys and little girls, about how to have healthy relationships mm-hmm. And to empower little girls and little boys to behave in a way that is healthy, mm-hmm. you know, when they're interacting on an emotional level, and when there's a problem, to speak out about it and to let people know, rather than us dealing with it at the far more serious end, you know, those right. tipping mm-hmm. points where victims are having to hide or we're having to hide them. Right. And this is where, again, the education process for law enforcement is that their duty of care, you know, in terms of public protection and keeping people alive, these are the most dangerous of cases. And that's why training, when you've got a fixated and obsessed person, it's not just going to go away.
Right.
You know, we're racking up multiple victims. You know, with Dirty John Meehan, I mean, really the podcast and now the shows have really lifted the lid on just how prolific he was.
Oh, yeah.
You were one of many.
One thing that I found numerous times, not just one time, but he had a backpack. And in his backpack, he had 24-inch, those ties, zip ties,
zip ties. Mm-hmm.
Knife, mask, tape, rope. So obviously, I think there's going to be victims out there that we either, you know, discover.
And by his own admission, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, how do you get away with things? You don't leave witnesses. You don't right. leave people who
right.
can say what you've mm-hmm. done. So, yes, backtracking that kind of psychological mm-hmm. autopsy through his life. Well, he learned from a very young age, didn't he, how to manipulate and how yeah. to game the system. And mm-hmm. his father taught him that yes. and his brother.
Yes.
I remember listening to the two sisters, Donna and Karen, mm-hmm. saying, you know, he was manipulating people. He was very charismatic.
Right.
He big into sports. He knew how to charm girls and women. He knew every line in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that the parents taught him. So he was kind of positively reinforced for that behavior. And even the nickname Dirty John came.
Right. Filthy John or Dirty John in college.
Right. And somehow that behavior mm-hmm. is rewarded rather than people thinking it's appalling and disgusting that,
right.
you know, he should be policed at that stage of people saying, well, it's not cool to treat girls and women like this. But he could turn it on and turn it off. And that's the point with his behavior. It was a strategic mm-hmm. and targeted way of behaving. And even I remember, you know, going back to the podcast where he was looking in the mirror and looking at himself with you in the early days and saying, damn, I'm so good looking.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this kind of, and that would make you laugh and chuckle.
Yeah.
But that probably is what he did genuinely think about himself.
I can guarantee yeah, yeah. it was all about John. Yeah.
The me, myself, and I, and that's uh-huh. the narcissism. Uh-huh. So again, that's what we see, one of the yeah. traits of psychopathy, that me, myself, and I. So when you're dating with someone, observe those things.
Right.
You know, observe how they behave under stress or in difficult situations. Mm-hmm. Is there leakage of really, you know, we call it sort of the angel demon or the Jekyll and Hyde of someone.
Mm-hmm.
That in one context, they're one thing. And then when you see them under stress or under pressure, you get leakage
right.
and you start, the mask slips and you yeah. start to see the person. You might just get a blink of the eye leakage where mm-hmm. you've got to make sense of that information. But again, those things are dismissed out of hand far too regularly, because once we're in that love bombing and that kind of, we want to believe the good stuff that we see, we don't want to believe the bad stuff that
right.
we see.
I don't think that John liked me from the beginning, because he saw me as a threat and I saw him as a threat also. When my mom started dating John, he immediately tried to put some space between us and gain more control over different areas of her and her life.
Did he also make you feel like, though, he couldn't live without you? And that,
oh, yes.
That, tell us about
oh, yeah.
that, about those kind of, that kind of ploy.
Early on, I mean, he was very playful. We had fun wherever we went. Everything was just enjoyable in the early
mm-hmm,
stages.
Sure. Honeymoon period.
Mm-hmm. The love bombing. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I noticed with John was that we would go places and he would want, it was like nobody else was in the room. Mm-hmm. All eyes were on me. Mm-hmm. And that's a good feeling, mm-hmm. you know, when someone you think is in love with you and you're in love with them. So it's the greatest feeling in my eyes.
But when he would make a mistake and then need your forgiveness, he would, it seems like he would be overboard, like, I need you.
Literally, I remember confronting him over a couple things and he started crying. He said, "I am so sorry, please forgive me." And I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. You know,
playing the
nobody's
victim.
Nobody's perfect. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Into the victim.
Very adept at playing the victim. And I love you. I need you. I need you in my life. And I can't do this without you. Yeah.
I want to die in your arms, you know.
You're the last thing I want to see.
Yeah.
You know, all these things that are very persuasive.
Right. So I have a tough question to ask you.
Okay.
Maybe it won't be tough, I don't know. So, you know, as Laura said on the podcast, he was really good at isolating you and turning you against the people who loved you and who supported you and maybe could see with a little bit more clarity. Like you said, Jacqueline, you know, had his number go. And I think some of the blowback you got, at least on our Facebook page for our listeners, is that people not understanding how, you know, you could, quote unquote, using air quotes, side with him against your family, your family who kept saying, you know, please don't marry him. There's something wrong with him, you know, over and over again, even when you were married, just trying to convince you and show you, you know, evidence. And so people have just a really hard time how any woman could choose a man over the family, your blood family. Can you talk to that a little
bit? Okay, first of all, my kids are grown adults.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not raising him.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, my life has been my work and my children. And they had been number one in my book. I felt that I created this great life for them.
Mm-hmm.
I worked hard for them. It was about, you know, giving them the best life I possibly could. At that point in my life, I felt it was my time. And I felt that they needed boundaries, healthy boundaries, and they needed to move on with their life, and we would have a wonderful relationship instead of mom being there for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gone to a psychologist of how to do this in a healthy way. And she said, it's your turn. You've done your job. They're raised. So on. So I felt it was my time to start meeting people. And
had they done this with other boyfriends?
Yes.
Or did
her,
oh, okay. So they did. Oh,
yes.
We didn't know that. Okay. So they done with other boyfriends. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's big.
Husbands. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
You know, what you want is this whole great family life.
Mm-hmm.
And you're wanting everyone to get along. Well, it's not that simple. But what I did was, I felt like I was trying to give them healthy boundaries. And so when Jacqueline was throwing a fit about John, I looked at it more that she wanted me,
mm-hmm.
you know, she didn't want, but really she saw through this guy is what it was. But, you know, it's hard when it's like the guy that cries wolf. So
yeah, this makes much more sense. This context that you're setting, that they had done this before. That's
I'm
really
very,
important.
Very close to my kids. And I was extremely close, maybe to a fault.
I remember a psychologist, you know, the counselor as well, played a role here of actually pushing you closer to John.
Yes.
By saying,
yes, and they agreed.
Boundary them, you know, make sure that this is your time.
Right.
And actually, you know, I train counselors and psychologists, and I always say, make sure you understand the context that somebody is describing to you, because is it love and attentiveness or is it control? And if they don't understand coercive control either, then advice in one context could be very, very dangerous in another context.
Right.
But you listened. You were listening to
the
counselor's
advice. I was
trying to do it right. You were.
I didn't want to make another mistake. So as far as I felt is I was just trying to do it the right way and get the girls to focus on their lives and moving forward and being adults and so on. So a lot of people judged me for that, mm-hmm. but they were adults. Mm-hmm. So
we're not talking about little children. You know, right. They were women in their own right. And I have to say, your family are fantastic. You know,
I love my family. I think that everyone had a role in all of this, not just Jacqueline and Tara, but my other two. And I felt that they really took on a certain role also. They just don't want to be in the media.
Sure. Ooh, I totally understand that. Yeah,
but my oldest daughter, boy, she is unbelievable. She's quite a gift.
She's super smart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yeah, you've got an incredible legacy to be very proud of.
Oh, thank you.
Unfortunately, John Meehan kind of got in the middle of all of it for a while.
But we're back.
Your future, right. And it's important that this is a narrative that, of course, you mm-hmm. learn from, we all learn from. And that, you know, the future, you take forward those lessons. And in terms of the family dynamics, you know, that I've seen great healing as well.
There's been healing. There's still bumps. I'm not going to say that it's perfect because it's not. There's still the PTSD sometimes comes out. The why didn't you listen to me attitude will come out. But we're working through it. It
can be very triggering. And now I have a question, Deborah, and it's, again, entirely up to you, really answer. But, of course, there's another subtext to what happened in your family, and it relates to your older sister, Cindy. Mm-hmm. Can you say anything about that situation and just, you know, where you were previously with it? Because I know when we met, it wasn't just International Women's Day. It was actually the anniversary of your sister's, sister being killed. So, yeah. And that was a very poignant meeting for mm-hmm. us because of those talking about, obviously, what happened to you, but it being International Women's Day.
Right.
And, you know, we toasted Cindy mm-hmm. because, you know, that in this narrative, somebody else's voice has been right. lost, hasn't it?
Yes. The one thing, when I look back, I tried to investigate that also, but it had been 10 years when I did the research, so I couldn't go anywhere with it, but I learned. I learned a lot what really happened to my sister. And I really look at it as coercive control. The way he dominated, isolated, was extremely jealous, and he's going to hate me for this, but
we won't say
it's
his
the
name,
truth.
So it's okay.
Okay. Nobody had a voice for her,
Mm-mm.
you know, mm-hmm. and I really feel that maybe it's time, because I saw the rippling effect it had on our family. My mom, I love my mom, and I think she is one of the best people you could ever meet out there, and she took it the route of forgiveness because she saw one parent better than none. As you guys know, I don't agree with what she did, but, you know, she is who she is, and I am who I am.
Right.
But she mourned my sister and tried to do everything to do her best. So, as far as Cindy, I just feel she didn't have a voice in this.
She's been forgotten and lost. Mm-hmm. And that's what we talked about in great mm-hmm. depth, because I, you know, I do agree with you. You know, that point in the podcast and in the story where you two were very close growing up.
Yes.
And to learn what happened. And of course that changes and the narrative, and just for you mm-hmm. and for your mother, you know,
right.
having this psychopath, this narcissistic psychopath
right.
who was targeting you
right.
with your mother already having lost Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you saying, you know, how close you and Cindy were and you'd mm-hmm. go out together. But actually
right.
her husband at the time, mm-hmm. who, as she went to separate from him,
mm-hmm.
he shot her in the house.
Right.
But he wouldn't let her go out. He would always follow her and mm-hmm. want to know where she was going. Can you just say a little bit about that, of what her life was like in terms of the rules and the regulations that were laid down for her?
Well, she got married at 18 on her birthday. And so she had a lot of growing up to do. And during that time frame, she was gorgeous. Just this beautiful Barbie doll figure, the whole works. And so he wouldn't let her go to the beach and wear a bikini. She had to wear a cover-up. We would go to the gym, and he would have to sit in his car outside and watch her. And there were things that I thought, oh, he's so jealous. This is ridiculous. And so there was one weekend, she was miserable for years and would always say, I can't do this, I can't do that. And I was living the life. I was living a fun life. I make anything fun. It's just who I am. And I took her away on this trip, and I took her to Palm Springs, where we were going to be sort of the life of the party.
Going out, socializing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sisters on the town.
Yeah. And I had two girlfriends with me also. But they wanted us to go to this club and just stand around and just greet people and so on. So I took her. And she met someone. And I can't really say who it is, sure. But he was famous. Mm-hmm. And so she saw a really fun side of life. And she came home, and that's when she decided, I can't do this any longer. I'm leaving. 2.5 weeks later, she's dead.
Mm. Just terrible.
Yeah. But we had no idea of the amount of abuse or anything like that. It was kept so quiet, 30-plus years ago. You didn't talk about it.
He seemed like the model husband, too. Once again, this Prince Charming who cares so much about his wife. Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting, Laura, that she kind of subconsciously learned what happens when you leave, right? Her sister tries to leave and boom. And so
you don't just leave.
You don't just leave with no consequences.
It really is the most dangerous time. And at the point where someone feels, it's that some people will say, oh, it's loss of control. Actually, this is them taking control.
Right.
And she had gone into the house. I believe she was signing checks and sat at the kitchen table. It's kind of the last part of the separation. And he walked into the house and he shot her in the head.
Right.
And what you learned
in the back of the head.
So in the back of the head, and what you learned about that was that there were measures and steps that he had taken. He had obviously been thinking about this, for at least a number of weeks.
Right.
Can you say anything more about that?
Well, one thing that I learned through all this is there are signs, and we ignored them because we had no knowledge. We had no education about what can happen. But learning the signs is such an important thing, and being there for them, getting them the help.
Okay.
And people reach out in different ways.
Right.
And that's something, when we're in training and certainly on the podcast, it's now we do talk about domestic abuse and coercive control and making it an acceptable conversation.
Ever.
Yes. And we're talking about 30 years ago, where there was shame and stigma. It wasn't talked about. Well, you stay with that person, you just get on with it. Mm-hmm. Divorce is, was seen as a big negative, connotation. Mm-hmm. So going back in time. But sometimes people reach out in different ways, and they won't. Even now, I would say there isn't a question in the dash that says, are you being coercively controlled?
Right.
We ask about behaviors.
Right.
And so when someone starts to tell you something, they might tell you about a behavior, or they might be upset about something. It might look quite innocuous to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point of, raising the profile and creating a risk toolkit. So we educate professionals, but we educate the mothers and the sisters and the brothers and the dads, the best friends, so that when we know that people reach out to their family and friends, first of all, before they even pick up the phone to the police or to an advocate, there will be a sustained pattern by the time they do reach out. But again, Cindy was very young.
Right.
She hadn't had, other relationships, and he was very controlling. Mm-hmm. And so for him, his entitlement, his right, her walking out the door, that was the point where things escalated, and sadly with very tragic consequence.
What can we do? Let's say we have a friend that is in a relationship and we see the signs of coercive control. What can we do?
We get this all the time, Laura. Please tell us, what do we do?
We do. And really the first thing is be a friend to that person. You know, the someone identifying, even if you're listening to this podcast or to others that we've done, identifying for you if you are the person who's being victimized, mm-hmm. that's a big step. Because normally, you know, 51, 52% of people don't realize they're being victimized.
Right.
So identifying and understanding it yourself. If you're the friend, if you're the mother, if you're mm-hmm. the sister that the reach out happens to, educate yourself about it. You know, if there are judgments or ultimatums laid down to the victim, that's one of the worst things you can do. So giving them the right advice, you know, talking about if they want to leave, leaving safely, putting mm-hmm. plans and measures in place, and that it is very much a thought out process. Mm-hmm. Giving them somewhere to go, helping them, whether it's financially or in any other way to enable them mm-hmm. to leave. And of course, that separation point, it might not be today, it might not be in 2 weeks, it could be in 6 months, it could be in a year. And what I notice about the clients who I work with, you know, and those who've reached out to us who've left safely, is that it's been a very slow plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And slow and deliberate, making sure you've got the passports, mm-hmm. making sure that mm-hmm. there's, you know, money that you right. may be putting into a separate bank account, making sure you change all your passwords.
Right.
You know, making sure you get a new phone so that you can't be tracked on the iPhone, making sure that you have a safe place to go to, you know, talking to your workplace so that they too understand what's happening to you, not allowing yourself to be isolated so that that perpetrator can then use other people. Mm-hmm. So having a network of people who understand, I think the workplace is a very important part yes. of it, because we spend about 80% of our lives there. And so, you know, you might be the boss as the victim. So mm-hmm. that might be one part, you know, to it. You can have more autonomy if you are. But if you're an employee, talk to your manager.
Right.
Show them the coercive control law in England and Wales and the different types of behaviours. And the DASH risk model is available to family and friends. So, and the victim can complete it too. So actually looking at where you are on that risk checklist can give you an indicator about, okay, I am high risk, you know, which can be alarming if someone realizes they're at high risk of serious harm and homicide. But equally, if you've been abused for a large or long period of time, it can mm-hmm. feel very routine. It's just become every part of your everyday right. existence. So again, some people don't realize what risk they're at because they've been managing. Mm-hmm. It's just been part of their everyday life. But if there are children involved, you know, again, children do tend to get used. And this is where the challenge is too. You know, the continued contact renders yourself further vulnerable to abuse. And in Tanya Bells's case, we actually heard some of the phone calls where he's threatening her. And I commented on it. He's threatening her. Then she has to hand over the children to this violent mm-hmm. abuser. Mm-hmm. And Chris Coffard kind of jokes about it, saying, well, on the one hand, you know, he's threatening you, saying your days on this planet are numbered. He's making a threat to kill. And then you've got to say, oh, and when you pick up, you know, your daughter, where is she going to sleep? And this is the real challenge of family courts. And, you know, if you don't hand over the mm-hmm. children, you can end up in prison.
Right.
So we have some campaigns running in the UK about mm-hmm. the family court, the civil process itself that abusers can use to legitimately stalk you and professionals who are complicit in that. So, which is why I always say, make sure that you get good advice, you know, and whether you're the sister, you know, going on Paladin's website, mm-hmm. We've got great advice of do's and don'ts, mm-hmm. but seeking, you know, a professional's opinion who's trained in stalking and trained in coercive control. And why I say that is because many still aren't. So this, you know, the psychotherapist, the counsellor, the psychiatrist, the people you know, may go to. Even if your friend works in law enforcement, that's not to say that they've been trained in this area.
In your case, that's what, right. that's what happened. The psychiatrist yeah. or psychologist wasn't trained.
Right. And always trust your instinct. You know, within one case, certainly with stalking, Dr. Lorraine Sheridan's research from 2005, we see at least 21 people around the victim who are affected. Mm-hmm. So that can be the sister, the mother, the brother, the father who's targeted. Mm-hmm. And perpetrators will make threats against your nearest and dearest, the people you care the most.
Oh, boy. Did I learn that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that tends to be mm-hmm. standard and routine. But mm-hmm. trusting your instinct, you know, if you're the victim or if you're the family member,
right.
despite what a professional is saying, always follow your instinct. And if you're a professional, please ensure that you're trained, you know, in coercive control and stalking. Don't dismiss victims out of hand and say things like, well, if they were going to do it, they would have done it by now. Right. I hear professionals say that all the time. Well, how do you know that? Mm-hmm. You know, the tipping point is always very different. I've been a professional working on cases for 20 plus years. Okay, so risk assessment, I do understand, but I would never say something like that. We want victims to bring their A game to the table. Mm-hmm. As Deborah did, you had the resources, you took the advice. We want you to be fully engaged in your own risk management. But we want professionals to really understand what's happening. And this is why ISACs, Independent Stalking Advocacy Caseworkers, who are university accredited and trained, who understand this area of these most dangerous of cases, and the mothers, the brothers, the fathers, the mm-hmm. sisters, you know, the best friends, educate yourselves.
So before I know we're going to have to wrap up, but a couple things, some of the things that our listeners have done when they feel like a friend or loved one is in danger, they sit down and have them listen to our podcast. That's one thing they do. Okay. They also sit with them and on their computer look up a shelter or Paladin, because they don't want that on the victim's, the potential victim's computer, because they're probably being tracked by their abuser. And then they also get the dash and they sit with them and mm-hmm. go through the dash. Now, some victims are not ready for that at all.
Yeah.
But just as Laura says, just letting them know you're here for them when they're ready to talk, when mm-hmm. they're ready to have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a long game that they're playing before they make a change, but that's something you can do. And there's only so much you can do.
But you might be the lifeline, you see, and that's why I call people lifelines. You might be the only one that the victim reaches out to. And so the advice you then give can be the difference between someone living or dying. And that sounds very dramatic, but remember, these are the most dangerous of cases. And it's why I call them murder in slow motion. It's for a reason. There's almost always a history, whether it's reported or not. And so, again, seeking advice from the police and using the term coercive control, we need to make it that it's discussed at dinner tables, mm-hmm. you know, that young people can talk about it, of what's happening, mm-hmm. and that jealous and controlling behavior is not romantic, you know, and unfortunately the younger generation, they think this relates to romance, of someone being jealous and or controlling. So there's a whole cultural shift, and that the blame and shame should rest with the perpetrator rather than saying to victims, why did you do that? Or why didn't you do X, Y, or Z? And the workplace, I mean, Lisa, you talked about, you know, using another computer, but this is where workplaces can be really important, you know, where you can access resources mm-hmm. in a safe way in an environment that the perpetrator knows nothing about. Right. But in the same breath, when we flip it on its head, 79% of perpetrators use their own workplaces to stalk and abuse the victim. So mm-hmm. again, in workplaces, no matter whether it's a bank or, you know, a shop or even in law enforcement, make sure there's a policy for how you deal with victims in your workplace of domestic mm-hmm. abuse and stalking, and how you deal with perpetrators.
Right.
You know.
Can I just take your hand for a second?
Sure.
Could you take Laura's hand for a second? So I'm the biggest thing about the Dirty John podcast was really for me was hearing about Cindy, because I mm-hmm. have a sister and Laura has a sister, and my heart just cried a million tears for your sister, and really just, so I'm so glad that you were able to talk about her today.
Oh, thank you.
It was really important for us that you were able to do that, because I know it's hard, and so I just wanted to thank you for that, and thank you for sharing.
Oh, you're so welcome.
So
my pleasure.
I always learned so much from Deborah, and you know, and from your incredible daughters as well, and every time we talk, there's something new. You know, it's been a real roller coaster, and you know, certainly spending time with your family, getting out to the much a better side and a more positive place, because mm-hmm. there's a future that is bright, and mm-hmm. there's lots mm-hmm. of opportunities that await.
Yes.
And so there is, that's the positive part. You know, mm-hmm. when people feel that they're locked in an abusive situation, mm-hmm. you can feel at times hopeless and helpless.
Right.
You're one of the most positive people I've met, Deborah.
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe know that, to a fault.
Well, you know, there are people who feel when your hope goes out, or you feel that there's no end to it, that's when we see, sadly, this, you know, the abuse, and victims can turn it inward. And that's where we see suicides happen too. So there's another side to abuse. You know, at least 10 women each week in the UK commit suicide because they can't see a way out.
Yeah, they don't have help.
They don't have hope and they don't have help. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in another sense, this your terrible experience has been turned into a strength. And I really thank you from the bottom of my heart for,
thank you.
You know, you call it airing your dirty laundry, but there are so many lessons in what you say. And I know our listeners will be, there'll be somebody sat there who has the light bulbs come on and now they'll be thinking about those next steps. And that's, they're really important messages. And the legacy of us, you know, I'm optimistic, we will go on to change the law. And that's a very true and real legacy and testament to your strength. So thank you so much for sharing.
I know that Jim would have loved to have been here. I'm so sorry that he wasn't here. And I know that he wishes he could have been here to meet you too.
And we still have much more to say. And, you know, we talked about Connie Britton coming in as well and us spending some time.
Love of my life, Connie Britton. Oh.
All I have to say is Connie is, I couldn't have asked for a better person to play my role. She really wants to get the word out there about that it could happen to just about anyone.
Such an important message. Yeah. And all her interviews, everything she said has been so on point.
Yeah.
And I know you've shared a huge amount. You really have put yourself out there. And I hope our listeners really do understand that that doesn't feel comfortable at times.
Doesn't, but it's so important.
It really is. So we're going to have further conversations with Deborah. Thank you so much for coming to the studio and being so authentic, being so honest and being so real. We really do appreciate that. And so for now, this is Real Crime Profile. Signing out. I've been talking a lot about the nuanced behaviour relating to stalking and to coercive control, and also preventing murder in slow motion. And I'm really excited. I've got an upcoming trip to London where I'll be facilitating and running a number of masterclasses. So I have got classes on the DASH risk assessment model and also the Train the Trainer, but they're already full. So I'll be running further classes in September. But you can also ask for either myself or one of my associates to come into your area if you are a professional and deliver training. And so the other courses that are available are March 26th, Stalking, of how to identify and understand behaviours, how to identify risk online and offline, the psychology of stalkers, how to apply the legislation and how to work with victims. And then on March 27th, I'm facilitating a masterclass on coercive control, how to identify the behaviours, risk online and offline, the legislation and how to work with victims. And March 29th, I'll be facilitating a Preventing Murder in Slow Motion class, which is the culmination and the sum of all the research and profiling and analysis that I've conducted on domestic violence murders and stalking-related murders. And I'll be talking about a lot of case studies and the 10 critical risk issues that we have to understand if we're going to protect and keep victims safe. Now, if you'd like further information on those classes or if you'd like to book, you can email jenny@laurarichards.co.uk, or you can look on the DASH Risk Checklist website. So I hope to see you in London, or you can book other classes should you wish. Thank you so much for listening to Real Crime Profile. If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, You can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.